Meeting the Maharishi by Sri A. Meenakshisundaram Iyer. This was not my first visit to Sri Ramanashramam. I had been there once before, but only for 10 minutes. About 4 years earlier, I had visited out of sheer curiosity. I arrived on one train and left by the very next. It was in the afternoon. The Maharishi was reading a newspaper. I prostrated and stood before him. The Maharishi did not even care to look at me, much less speak a word. My pride was wounded. More than 4 years rolled by. Then I read references to him as a yogi who had realized the religious people of Madura were celebrating Ramana's Jayanti, and I wondered how a Jayanti was being celebrated in his own time. Had I mistaken the Maharishi when I saw him sitting on soft cushions in comfortable surroundings, ignoring the adoration of a believing crowd? Possibly so. Contrition began to eat away at me, and I decided to make a second visit. I reached the ashram at about 10 in the morning. I went straight into the hall. As before, the Maharishi was reading a newspaper, but when he saw me at the entrance, he looked up and welcomed me, saying, "Come in." As I turned round to sit, I was surprised to find, just opposite to me, a form that seemed like a waxen image, perhaps a lady. It was a motionless, life-sized figure. Closer observation soon convinced me that it was indeed a person of flesh and blood. Then, turning back, I perceived a number of men, some with half-closed eyes and some in attitudes of deep meditation. Brunton has written that the vicinity of the Maharishi is perfumed with an atmosphere of peace, and the devotees were obviously engaged in meditation with the help of that atmosphere. In a few minutes, the bell rang in the dining hall, and the meditators awoke to their mundane existence. Though I had come to the ashram after eating, I too joined the diners, more to see the Maharishi than to eat. The Maharishi was at the head of the group, seated in the general dining section. He knows no distinction of caste, but existing scruples were respected, and I was led into the adjoining Brahmin section, the division being made by a thatched fence. Meals over, we proceeded to the tap outside to wash our hands, where I discovered that the waxen figure I had seen earlier was a young European woman whom I unsuccessfully endeavored to draw into conversation. It was now midday, and the inmates and visitors adjourned for rest, but I was restless in spite of the need for rest after a night's journey in the train. I therefore wandered aimlessly for a short distance from the hall and observed a row of numbered thatched sheds, which evidently provide accommodation for visitors. I peeped into one of them, whose wicket door was half open. Its inmate, an old Iyengar gentleman, beckoned me to walk in. He talked admiringly about his neighbor, a young French lady who had become a Buddhist nun, Sujata Sen. I at once recognized her as the lady at the tap. I learned that she had married a Bengali IMS officer, but soon preferred a meditative life to one of luxury. She had wandered over the Himalayas and performed tapas in the wilds of Tibet. When About a month earlier, she had arrived at Ramanashramam. The place was full of visitors and there was no accommodation. She thereupon spent her nights on the slopes of the hill until a hut fell vacant. Her hair was closely cropped after the manner of Buddhist bhikshus. What renunciation for one of her race and of her youth! Occasionally, I saw her moving in and about the ashram with an eel-like elusiveness. The sun was beating fiercely outside, the Maharishi saw, but it was cool within. The floor had just been washed, and as soon as the carpets were spread, devotees had gathered and were already seated when I walked in. Here and there, men devotees were sitting and I joined them. A little while later, I rose with trepidation and with a beating heart and a suppliant posture, approached the Maharishi. A kindly smile welcomed me, yet with a faltering voice, I made my submission to him, which was that I wanted to clear a long-standing problem of mine relating to past and future births. The Maharishi listened in patient silence to my lengthy introduction. When I finished, he said, "You wish to know what you were and what you will be. Have you considered what you are? It is important to know yourself, to know what you are, and you will then have known what ought to be known." I recognized that it is more practical to know what I am than what I was or what I will be. And I cited the example of Buddha, who refused to answer questions about God or the ultimate reality. He was more concerned with instructing people on how to attain happiness. The Maharishi interjected, "For this he has been misconstrued to be a sunyavadi, nihilist." I said, "I have an intellectual cognition of what I am, based on the data of science and theorizing on them. I also have just an intellectual cognition that I am Brahman and that Brahman alone exists." The Maharishi said, "You can only say, 'I am,' and no more. Anything more will imply duality and limitation. It is not enough that you have a mere intellectual cognition of the truth. That is no good without realization. Is it this Atmajnanam or that knowledge of self that Jesus meant by the expression 'kingdom of heaven'?" I asked. The reply was, "Yes, Vedantins can understand him." Incidentally, I referred to Sri Krishna as a human friend of Arjuna, though he on one occasion showed his supreme self to Arjuna by giving him his own Samashti Chakshu vision of the reality. The Maharishi pointed out that Krishna did not show Arjuna the reality, but only enabled him to see through Krishna's own eyes like a mesmerist. What was given to Arjuna for the occasion was not Samashti Chakshu, but Divya Chakshu, a divine vision. The stars and the worlds that Arjuna saw were not real. Space is not real. Time also is not real. Shankara is sometimes charged with denying any reality to the phenomenal world, I said. The Maharishi repudiated the idea that phenomena are unreal in all respects. That alone, he said, can be called real, which is permanent and does not change. How can the world reality, he asked, be applied to phenomena which undergo change and transformation every instant? It would be a wrong application of language to describe as real what undergoes change every instant. Such changeful appearances are not what knowing and what everyone ought to know is the true self, the absolute, which includes all. Sourced from the Sunday Times, March 21, 1937.